Hi, this is James Barris. I hope you find this talk supports you in your practice. If you'd like to support my teaching, you can use the donate button underneath my picture on Dharma Seed to do that. Your support is greatly appreciated.
So, I was thinking about different topics to talk about. First, I was looking through some suttas, and I was looking through a really wonderful book that Bhikkhu Bodhi compiled called Great Disciples of the Buddha. It's actually something that was originally put together by Jnanapanika Thera, one of his mentors, and a scholar named Helmut Hecker. And one of the chapters there's lots of different chapters of famous disciples like Sariputta and Ananda and Mahamoggallana, etc., etc. And then there's one chapter that says women, great women disciples of the Buddha, all in one chapter, however. And I thought, well, they don't get a whole lot of airplay in that book, but there are some really wonderful, powerful women disciples. And I thought, well, I think it would be really good, especially seeing how usually on retreats, 2/3 of the yogis are women, and they are really such sincere practitioners. And I try to have sources of great women wisdom teachers, and there's many these days, of course. Probably lots of people are fans of Tara Brach, Pema Chodron, Sharon Salzberg, Sylvia Boorstein, Christina Feldman, many, many wonderful female teachers. But you don't hear a whole lot about the great women disciples of the Buddha. So I thought that I would spend an evening sharing some of their stories and explore a little bit about women's place in the Buddha's teaching from the earlier days, just the as much as I can, the honest way that they are held, and the complexities as well. We can't get into all of that, but I used a number of resources. One is this book, Great Disciples of the Buddha, and that chapter on women. There's a number of books that you might be interested in following up. This one is called The First Buddhist Women by Susan Murcott. This has been out for some time, and she goes through some of the really great stories of these women, and there are teachings that have come down from these women. There's a whole collection of women's teachings called, in the Pali Canon, called the Terigata. I'll put it in the chat box. Terigata. The Terigata. These are a collection of women's poems and teachings that are really inspiring. And I also used another resource, this book that's come out in recent times called The First Free Women by Maddie Weingast. And it's a foreword by Aya Ananda Bodhi, Bhikkhuni Ananda Bodhi. And this is the Terigata that it's a guy, Maddie Weingast, adapted and made into very poetic contemporary renditions of these teachings. So that was another resource. Here's another book for those who are interested called The Feminine Faces of The Feminine Face of Buddhism by Jill, G-I-L-L, Farrer Halls, Farrer-Halls, The Feminine Face of Buddhism. Thich Nhat Hanh has a beautiful compilation of stories from the time of the Buddha. This is called Old Path, White Clouds. And he takes a lot of the discourses and from the Pali Canon and puts his very accessible, poetic retelling of these stories and many stories of women in this book. I've used all of these. I was looking through all of these for different renditions of these stories. Then there's this book that I thought that some of you might be interested in called The Buddha's Wife. And this is by Jan Suri, Surrey, The Path of Awakening Together. And Jan is she was in Community Dharma Leaders program that I led, and she's a therapist, and she, besides giving some historical background, she created a story of the Buddha's wife, who the Buddha left before he set out on his quest for enlightenment, and she gives a fictionalized imagining of what Yasodhara, the Buddha's wife, went through. And Yasodhara became a practitioner and became enlightened, as I recall. But speaking from her point of view, what that was like for her husband to leave. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but I'll share it with you, that the Buddha, before he became the Buddha, when he was the prince, Siddhartha, he was married to her at the age of 16, Yasodhara. I'll put her name in the chat box. Yasodhara. And he was with her. He left the palace at 29, so he was with her for quite a few years. And he also had courtesans. This was something that was just the custom then. Kings and princes, and he was into a royal family, took many wives and had courtesans. And in fact, he had a harem. There was a whole harem of Prince Siddhartha's. And in fact, about 12 of his harem later became disciples and joined the monastic order, became nuns. So there is some controversy. First, you might think, whoa, what is that about? Here is this great spiritual being who leaves the day that his son is born. I'll just share with you the honest, how it's come down to us, the honest story. And his son was named Rahula, which means fetter or obstacle. Now, it's fortunate that he came back, taught Rahula, who became a monk and became enlightened. But this is just something to somehow come to terms with, that he wanted to go on his quest, and he saw that the householder life was not going to point him in the direction of what he was looking for, because he saw that his life was just filled with desires being gratified, and he was very motivated when he went out on a journey at 29 and saw that there was no way, as good as he had it, to get around old age, sickness, and death. And so he left the palace. He was also inspired by a renunciate, an ascetic monk who was looking for the deeper kind of happiness, and he was inspired to find what that monk was on quest for. And he practiced the most austere practices in the next 6 years, and came back at the age of 35. Actually, he was enlightened at the age of 35, and came back after he was enlightened, when his son was 7. So he came back a year after he was enlightened to his home, and he then shared the Dharma. And when he shared the Dharma, his wife was not so thrilled when he came back. Like, oh, now you're coming back? Where were you for all of those years? But his mother, his foster mother, who was also his aunt, did receive him and welcome him. And her name was, I'll put it in the chat box, Maha Pajapati. And she was his mother's sister. So she was his aunt and also was his foster mother, because the Buddha's mother died shortly after giving birth. Died, I think it was like 6 or 7 days after she gave birth, she died. So he did not have his mother to care for him and have that bond with his mother, but he did have his mother's sister, Mahapajapati, who also was married to the king. The king, Suddhodana, had a number of wives, and her sister took the baby and suckled him and raised him as her own. And when he came back, she welcomed him, and he said, I've found what I was looking for, and I want to share it with everyone, those who would listen. Now, while he was gone, all of these women who were in his harem, and then others who, when he came back, their husbands joined the order. All of these women, all of a sudden, didn't have the protection of a man, which in those days was how you got your prestige and status. And so all of these women were kind of without any protection, and they became students and went to Mahapajapati for protection. And when Mahapajapati became a student of the Buddha, all of these women started to go to her for support, because in the earlier days, women were not welcomed to become members of the monastic order. And this was difficult. And Mahat Prajapati was the one who was the start of the order, because she said, hey, all of these women, now the men are joining your order, becoming monastics, and the women are now left without any man or protection, and are not given any prestige or given any status in the community. And she went to the Buddha, who did teach her and was happy to teach lay people, and she said, would you please start a nun's order as well? And he said, please don't ask for this. She asked again. You know, usually if you ask enough, then you get what you ask for. But she asked three times and was refused each time, because in those days, it just was, my understanding is, he thought it was going to be very complicated to have nuns to look after as well as monks, and the whole sexual component was going to be complicated, and he thought that the monks would be attracted and get into trouble. For whatever reason, he refused her the three times she asked. The story goes on, and he goes to another place in the countryside to give a teaching, and she decides, with a whole retinue of women who are now her students, to make the trek on their own and follow him and keep on asking. She was very persistent and determined. And she goes to Ananda, who is the Buddha's attendant and closest to the Buddha, and who also had a very loving heart. Ananda means bliss, blissful, the joyful one. And she goes to Ananda instead of going straight to the Buddha. And she says, listen, we have all of these female devotees, and they want to become nuns. They want to have the protection of the robes. They don't have any place in society. They want to live the holy life, just like the monks. So Ananda goes to the Buddha, and he asks the Buddha, will you please let women join the order? And he also is refused. Don't ask me this, Ananda. Now, this is the Buddha, so you've got to kind of stretch yourself and say, oh, well, maybe the Buddha didn't always have it right. And Ananda asked three times, and each time the Buddha refused. And then Ananda gets a bright idea. And he says, let me ask you, O Lord, is it possible for a woman to become fully enlightened? And the Buddha thought, and he said, yes, it is possible. Now, the Buddha also said that the holy life, taking robes, is the best way to become fully enlightened. So he says, well, if women could become enlightened and being in robes is the best way to achieve that, how can you deprive women of that possibility? I thought you wanted to have as many awakened beings as possible. That got to the Buddha. And he thought about it and he said, okay, we'll let women become nuns and be in the order. However, he said, I want to institute 8 additional rules. Oh, if you keep things still in there so it's not distracting, that's good. Thank you. And the one rule that is really the key is a nun of whatever length of seniority is not held in as, I shouldn't say high regard, a nun is behind the most junior monk when they get in line for food, when they have whatever is shared in the community, and a nun must bow to a junior monk, no matter how senior. This has been a cause of great pain for many wonderful Buddhist nuns, and I just want to bring you up to date now on in the last several years, where when the nuns were asked about changing that order, particularly in Ajahn Chah's Theravadin scene, the Amaravati monks, led by Ajahn Sumedho, who's a real benefactor of mine, and the other senior monks, didn't feel it was up to them to change it because they get their support from Thai communities, and this was going to upset a whole lot of Thai Sangha, which supports the Amaravati and the Theravada communities. So they were not willing and able to change. And that created a big kind of controversy in the Theravada community. And Ajahn Brahm, a monk in Australia, said, I will ordain you. And so he did, because the Theravada, the Bhikkhuni order had died out, and you needed a Theravadin nun in order to ordain other Theravadin nuns. And he said, I will ordain. And that started a new order of Theravadin nuns that Aya Ananda Bodhi, Aya Santachitta, who has a community and a home in San Rafael that you can visit, Aloka Vihara. They've started, there is a new order of nuns. And just to give you the backstory on these different controversies. Okay, so now I want to share some of the nuns from the earlier days. So there's Maha Pajapati, who took the nuns in, or took the women in, and started that first the first nuns order, and was really like the mother of the Sangha. was beloved by so many. Then there's a few other of the stories, and I realize time is running out, so I want to share with you some that might be interesting to you. One of the most beloved is named Patachara. And she was a skillful, revered, charismatic teacher. And she was from a banker's family. And she ran away. Her family wanted to marry her to some arranged marriage to some wealthy guy. She, however, fell in love with the servant and ran away with the servant, one of her servants, as her lover. And they had a good life, but far away. And she gave birth to one child. And it's said when you give birth, it's good to, a woman gives birth, they try to go back to the family, to the home of the of their parents as a kind of blessing. And she thought, I'll go back with my child, and my family will welcome us back. She didn't make it in time with the first child, but when the second child was born, or when she was pregnant, because she gave birth before she could get back to her family, when the second child was she was pregnant with the second child, she started to make the trek back to her family. Her husband at first didn't want to go back because he thought he'd get into a whole lot of trouble. He was the servant. But he went and caught up with her, and he said, okay, I'm coming with you. And she had one child who was a few years old and this baby about to be born. And on this trip, this is kind of a pretty intense story, so be ready. On this trip, there's a huge storm, and the husband is gathering wood to put up shelter on their trip from this storm, and gets bitten by a poisonous snake. And she doesn't know where he is. He doesn't come back. He was going to gather wood and create some kind of a shelter for them. And there she is, thinking that she's been abandoned. But this huge storm, all she can do is just protect her two children. The next day, when the storm clears and she sees that her husband has died from the snake bite, and now she really has to get back to her family because she's all alone. And she tries to cross the river, which by then had overflowed, and it was too big to carry both children. So she gives birth meanwhile. On this, just before this storm, she gives birth. She carries the infant over to the other side because she can't carry both the infant and the child. She puts the infant on the other side, goes back to get the child, and while she's going back, a hawk comes and grabs the child. And she screams, flips out, no, 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 no. And the child, the older child, thinks that she's calling him to come. He comes in and he drowns. This is like, you know, the most intense story you can imagine. Her husband dies of a poisonous snake. One child picked up from a hawk, the other child drowns in the river. She says, I've got to go back to my home. I don't know what to do. She goes kind of crazy, and she says, where are my parents? Where's the family of so-and-so? And she's told, oh, don't ask. Your parents, their whole house collapsed in the storm. She has nothing. This is the story of Patachara. She goes crazy. Fortunately, it's right near where the Buddha is. And she goes to the Buddha half naked, basically, and out of her mind. And the Buddha, as he does in a lot of these stories, says, Patachara, bring mindfulness, calm down. And she kind of calms down, and he gives her a teaching on the impermanent nature of life. And in her open state, she gets first stream entry and becomes first stage of enlightenment. She continues practicing and then gets to full enlightenment. And there's a poem of Patachara. Let's see if I can find her poem. Where is it? Page 33 here. And she has a poem about how she I was in a bad way, a widow, no children, no friends, no relations to give me food and clothes. I was a beggar with a bowl and stick and wandered. And we have, then I, bathing my feet, I've done everything right since finding my way and followed the rules of my teacher. Bathing my feet, I watched the bathwater spill down the slope. I concentrated my mind the way you train a good horse. Then I took a lamp and went to my cell, checked the bed and sat down. I took a needle and pushed the wick down. When the lamp went out, my mind was freed. Each of these has a poem. And she taught many, many nuns. It's one of these stories where if you've gone through the dukkha yourself, then you know what it's like to be freed. So that's Patachara's story. I'll share with you another one, Kema, the foremost nun of great wisdom. And she was beautiful and very attached to appearance. A lot of these nuns were incredibly beautiful in their life and were either the subject of a lot of attention from men or became very vain. And she was married to a king, King Bimbisara, who loved the Buddha's teaching, and he wanted her to become a student of the Buddha's. And she said, no, he doesn't like beauty, and I like beauty. And he had someone, some minstrels sing to her about her beauty and about how beautiful the monastery was that the Buddha had set up in the grove. And she and said, you've got to check out this monastery. It's so beautiful. And what she did, she said, okay, well, that sounds pretty good. I'll check it out. And she goes and sees the Buddha. You know, she's a little bit concerned because she's saying, well, you know, I thought the Buddha doesn't like women and like beauty. But she goes there anyway. And the Buddha knows where she's at in her mind. And he makes this image through whatever superpowers he has, psychic powers, he creates this image that she sees of this unbelievably beautiful celestial being, female. And she says, "Wow, I thought I was beautiful. This is real beauty." And then this image, through the Buddha's production, starts turning older and older and older until becoming an old lady who's missing her teeth and very haggard and seeing, oh, this is where this is headed. And with that, she gets it. This is only going in one direction, and she becomes a disciple of the Buddha and has this poetry. "Behold the mass of elements, diseased, impure, decaying, trickling all over and oozing. It's desired only by fools. Those enslaved by lust drift down the stream as a spider glides on its self-spun web. Having cut off even this, the wise one wander indifferent to the pleasures they've renounced." And she becomes the foremost nun of great wisdom when she sees the power of impermanence. So this is another one of the Buddha's nuns. There's the story of Kisa Gotami, who is well known. When her son dies, and this is how she has gotten any kind of prestige in her life, because she was not beautiful, but she was married to somebody who appreciated her, even though she wasn't. But she was mistreated by his family until she gave birth to a son. And once she gave birth to a son, her stature rose. And when her stature rose, she said, "Oh, this was all worth it." And then the son dies. And she says, "Oh, I'm going to lose everything right now." He can't die. She couldn't accept the fact that he would die. And in fact, she doesn't let that fact in. And she says, "There's got to be some kind of medicine that can save my son's life." And she goes from house to house, "Do you have any medicine that can save me?" And finally somebody says, "The only one that could possibly save you is the Buddha. And he's staying not far from here." She goes to the Buddha with this lifeless child in her arms and says, "Please bring my son to life and health. Can you do that?" And the Buddha says, "Yes, I can help you. You need some very special medicine." "What is it?" He said, "Bring me some mustard seeds." "Mustard seeds? Sure. There's mustard seeds. Everybody has mustard seeds." He says, "But it has to be very special mustard seeds. They have to come from a house where no one has died." She says, "Okay, I'll do it." And she goes from door to door. "Do you have mustard seeds?" "Oh yes, of course we have mustard seeds. Has anybody died here?" "Oh, of course. Last year, my uncle died." "Oh, of course. My mother died." Every place that she went to, somebody had died, until she got the teaching. This happens to everyone. And she goes back to the Buddha and she says, "I get it. There's no getting around death." and she becomes a nun and has many women disciples learning from her the truth of impermanence, the truth of old age, the truth of illness, the truth of death, the truth of loss. And she's a great nun. So there are a few more, but maybe I'll just stop here and see. This might have stirred things up in you. Just want to open it up and see if you have any thoughts, any comments, any observations. And just to one thing I'll say towards as I end is that the Buddha was hugely progressive in his time, even though it seemed like women didn't get such a good deal. He was considered radical to even let women in the order and to teach women who weren't even open to hearing teachings by in the Brahmin worlds. So as backward as it might seem, he was hugely progressive. And now, hopefully, in these years, we'll start to relax things a bit and give women the place that they deserve equally. Certainly, as far as yogis, as far as capacities to be free, many of these women, female nuns, became fully enlightened arhats. Hopefully we'll be learning more and more these days. So I thought I saw a hand out. Kimberly, hi.
Hi, James. Thank you for this. Thank you. It's wonderful to be reminded of all of this. And I have a question about adapting our study in Vipassana, okay? So taking in everything you said and everything we've learned about, we understand what the times were and how the Eightfold Path and everything was developed. Sorry, I'm in the car, so I'm sorry it's bouncing. Tell me to turn off the camera and I will. Anyway, it's new, right? This is going on, the machinations are happening. So it's hard to articulate. I adapt what I know and what I'm learning. So I hear what you're saying, and for the times, and even now, unfortunately, the nuns would be behind the lowest ranking apprentice, male. Monk. I understand, and I don't need to make dukkha out of that or anything. What I'm curious to do is, with all of the rules and dogmas with this, where do we decide to soften? Where do we not? You know, Eve talks about this sometimes, and it's interesting. And Eve is wonderful and says, adapt whatever you want and be as flexible as you want. And that is wonderful and lovely. And then when we're in maybe a different sangha where somebody's very black and white and very rigid and like, no, you can't do that, and shoulds on us, right? And I don't like to should on anybody. But I'm curious on your take. Sorry, that took a while to articulate. But, you know, on how rigid, where do we go?
Well, actually, since 2009, since Ajahn Brahm ordained some women, there has been a revival of a bhikkhuni order. That's where Aya Ananda Bodhi and Aya Santa Chitta, they are both in, I'll put this in, Aloka Vihara. You go to alokavihara.org and you can visit Santa Chitta, and Ananda Bodhi is not living there now, but they teach, and they have their own. They don't bow down to the novice monk. They have their order that is on equal footing. It's just not in the Amaravati order. And so we're starting something that's new. We're starting something. The monastics is different from the lay, of course. So there's, like I said, there's Tanisara, and who was a nun for many years in Amaravati, and there's
I can't think of her last name. Yes, also
Tanisara. Yeah, Tanisara, yes. Tanasanti, and you know, all the great lay women teachers. Spirit Rock has probably as many women teachers, female teachers, as male teachers. So we're starting something new here.
And there's the Kaya Asasana. I'm not saying it right. In the East Bay, the women's Sangha.
Asaya Sangha, yeah.
Kate
Munding's Asaya Sangha. Yeah. Asaya Sangha, and they meet regularly. And so we're starting something, it's new. And the women teachers are certainly as respected and revered and popular as the male teachers. It's just these things in the strict Theravadin, the Amaravati Sangha anyway, this is still part of the deal. And I want to say that with tremendous gratitude, the Amaravati Sangha, Ajahn Amaro is one of my favorite teachers of all. He's the head of the Amaravati Sangha now. He took over from Ajahn Sumedho. When I go on retreats, my self-retreats, I often listen to Ajahn Amaro. I'm putting him in the chat box. Just a fantastic teacher. And he is still bound by these rules. But I love him, and I love Ajahn Sumedho, and the Buddha said, you think for yourself, you see for yourself what's true and what's not true, and that's the ultimate place to go and to really reflect on what's true for you. So we're starting a whole new time in this generation. Any other comments or questions? Maggie, hi.
Hi, James. Yes, because it does seem a shame that it's gone on for this long. It's taken to this time for us to just be equal. And I do hope that going forward that things can change and people can really see that it's just like, it's not the color of your skin, it's not your gender either that counts.
I do think it's just a matter of time, even in the monastics, because it's outdated.
Yeah,
the way I see it personally. And at the same time, I really want to respect the choices that are made, as much as I wish it were different. So I take my teachings wherever I find them, and honor each person making their own way. So,
and we think for ourselves.
What's that? And thinking for ourselves.
And we think for ourselves.
Yes. And having sangha, people who you feel like-minded, and feel that you belong. I mean, that's the point, for everyone to feel like they belong. Okay, so it's time to go. So just want to appreciate you hanging in there with all of this, and may our coming here together nourish each of us, be a benefit to to ourselves and everyone in our lives, and may we share the merit with all beings everywhere in this beautiful planet. So, have a good week and take good care. I think Eve is going to be with us next week. So, I'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.